Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for March 18th, 2011. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the Sendai earthquake, although anticipated, still astonished seismologists. An increasingly attractive option for storing hydrogen for fuel cells, and testing whether it is better to be evolutionarily fit or evolutionarily flexible.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The Japan Meteorological Agency issued a tsunami warning very, very quickly after the shaking stopped.
Science's Dennis Normile reports from Japan on the Sendai earthquake and its aftermath. Science's Earth and Planetary Sciences reporter Dick Kerr also joins us.
Some initial waves hit the coast near the epicenter as little as 8 minutes after the shaking. But those were deceptively small waves. And this may be one of the factors that could have convinced people that maybe there weren't major tsunami coming. But major waves came 30 minutes after the shaking. And it is clear from looking at, you know, the video clips that appeared on NHK that a lot of people were sort of going about their daily lives even as the waves started coming over the coast. You had people driving along highways who probably could not see that the waves were coming over the embankments along the coast, whereas NHK was broadcasting video taken from a helicopter. It was really heartbreaking. I watched this in live time, and you wanted to shout to these people in their cars, run, turn your car around and go the other way, or do something, because it was clear that, you know, major waves were coming. And a lot of people were either not aware or not taking appropriate action.
We've seen, all of us, the video of NHK, the Japanese television, and the destruction that tsunami wrought in Sendai particularly. Why is Sendai, the Sendai region, particularly vulnerable to tsunamis?
There is a broad, flat plain, and high ground and tall buildings are really scarce. So to escape from that plain, you have to start as soon as the shaking stops, because in some areas, it's really a long way, you know, from where you might be living to a safe place.
To what extent did the earthquake, before the tsunami arrived, cripple infrastructure that people might have used to escape the tsunami?
Actually, in this case, the preliminary indications are that the infrastructure and buildings largely withstood the initial shaking. Most of the damage has been done by the tsunami.
Dick Kerr, you cover Earth and Planetary Sciences for Science Magazine. Your thoughts?
That contrasts considerably with the situation in Christchurch, New Zealand, where they had a much smaller earthquake, but it was the rupturing fault was essentially under the city, and there was a great deal of structural damage. In the Japanese case, the rupturing fault is well offshore, more than 100 kilometers. And even though it was a much larger earthquake, the combination of the good structural design, the sound construction, and the distance from the fault combined to minimize the amount of infrastructure damage.
I think that
Dennis
can also be seen by comparing the Kobe earthquake to this latest earthquake. Just as in Christchurch in 1995, the earthquake was really directly underneath Kobe City. And so, you know, if your earthquake is directly under the city, the shaking that is exerted on the buildings can be more intense than if the earthquake is at some distance from the city, even though, you know, the earthquake some distance from the city may be a much larger earthquake.
As I understand it, it's now agreed that this earthquake is magnitude 9.0. What was the structure, the fault that slipped or ruptured? Dick?
The fault is down in the Japan Trench, which is offshore of the island of Honshu. That's where the Pacific plate is diving beneath Japan on its way down to the Earth's mantle. And it's where the diving plate rubs against the island rock, sticks, builds up stress, strains the rock, deforms it until it can't handle it anymore, and the fault slips suddenly. All that seismic energy flows away in seismic waves.
Were seismologists expecting an earthquake there then, Dennis?
This is one of the most interesting questions about this earthquake. Seismologists were, in fact, expecting an earthquake in this same region, within the same time frame. However, the earthquake they expected was only on the order of a magnitude 7.5 earthquake, much, much smaller than the magnitude 9 earthquake that actually hit. This points up some of the difficulties of relying on the historical record.
That's how earthquake risk is currently assessed?
Yes. But, of course, the historical record, the record as recorded by modern instruments, really only goes back maybe 60 years. Less advanced instrumentation goes back 100-plus years. And then beyond that, you have to look at and try to model what happened by looking at evidence from faults, evidence from deposits by tsunamis, and, you know, historical records by political entities. And I think one of the lessons of this quake is going to be that it is really difficult to predict the future by looking at the historical records, because the farther back you go, the less complete the historical record is. And so if you are looking for events that may only recur on a timescale of 1,000 years, it's really difficult because we simply don't have reliable and complete historical records that go back that far.
Does this suggest to seismologists then that the pressure has been relieved for the foreseeable future, or are earthquakes independent events and or may influence the production of other earthquakes? Dick?
That particular section of fault has been de-stressed, so it's going to take maybe 1,000 years to build the stress back up. What seems to be an immediate concern among seismologists is that these stress changes brought on by the big one can take in the extension of the same fault both to the south and to the north. The stress, some of it has been passed down along the fault, possibly adding to the stress of faults in the region. And more disconcertingly, it can even influence side faults and faults that are not even directly connected to that fault in the Japan Trench. So, for example, preliminary calculations are suggesting that some of that stress has been added to the fault much closer to Tokyo, still offshore, but much closer to Tokyo. And that region, I think it was several hundred years ago, seems to have had one of these historic earthquakes large enough to generate a significant tsunami. So just because the big one has come and gone doesn't mean that the threat is gone. In fact, in some places, the threat may be heightened.
Obviously, Japan has really good building codes for surviving earthquakes, but that hasn't meant that the nuclear reactors that are there didn't suffer damage. We've been hearing ongoing reports about radiation concerns. Dennis, from Japan, what do you hear ongoing? Is the idea to evacuate more and more and more?
The situation at the nuclear power plants is still unfolding. What we do know is that the power plants were designed anticipating a maximum earthquake of approximately magnitude 8.2. The structures, by and large, survived a magnitude 9.0 earthquake. In one sense, they performed very well. But obviously, in another sense, they have not performed. We had a system where the structures withstood the initial shock, but they lost power. The backup power provisions were then knocked out by the tsunami. And then ad hoc measures that were attempted to keep the reactor cores at a low enough temperature to avert meltdown have failed. And so that's where we are. So going forward, what this will mean for nuclear power plant design, of course, remains to be sorted out. It may mean hardening backup systems to withstand extraordinarily unexpected events. It may mean, you know, having backups for backups. It's not clear yet.
Is there any consensus growing about the best strategy for mitigating effects, damage from future tsunamis?
I don't know if there is a consensus growing. Clearly, people need to be educated that they should not wait for warnings, that they should be aware of escape routes in advance and flee as soon as there's a major earthquake.
Dick?
You know, that was dramatically demonstrated a couple years ago when a major tsunami hit the island of Samoa. Some died, a couple score, I believe, but thousands of people escaped to the high ground, and they did that largely because only a few months before they had received instruction on what to do in the case of feeling a strong shaking from a large nearby earthquake. And, you know, whole schools would immediately pick up and go to the high ground. Obviously, there are two factors you need, education and a reasonable place to escape to. In the Samoan case, they had the two. In this Sunday case, especially the second one, an easily accessible high ground of some sort was not always accessible.
Dennis Normile and Dick Kerr, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, guys.
Dennis Normile in Japan with Dick Kerr here in Washington, D.C., reporting this week's Science and Online on the Sendai earthquake and its aftermath. To read the article and follow Science's ongoing coverage, including answers to reader-submitted questions, go to news.sciencemag.org and click on Japan Earthquake. The promise of a hydrogen economy means powering cars, boats, as well as other vehicles and devices with electricity generated by fuel cells and eliminating global dependence on coal and oil. But there are several obstacles to getting to a hydrogen economy, including how to store hydrogen, a readily explosive gas. One potential method is to store it within a substance called ammonia borane. But without an efficient method of recycling the spent ammonia borane after the hydrogen has been liberated from it, there's little chance for wide-scale adoption of ammonia borane as a hydrogen storage medium. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Andrew Sutton, John Gordon, and colleagues report an efficient, straightforward method to solve this problem and recycle, or rather regenerate, rehydrogenate, the spent ammonia borane. I spoke with Sutton and Gordon from their offices at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Here's Andrew Sutton.
Ammonia borane's a great material for hydrogen storage. You can store nearly 20% hydrogen in it, and you can liberate hydrogen from it quite readily. The main problem, however, is actually getting the hydrogen back in to the ammonia borane. So you can actually have a complete cycle where you can dehydrogenate ammonia borane, put the hydrogen back in, and essentially repeat this. The trick has been in the past, how do you get the hydrogen back in? And essentially, the basis of this paper has been using hydrazine in liquid ammonia to do this in one pot in a single stage reaction. And this regenerates ammonia borane in over 95% yield. So it's a nice, high-yielding, simple reaction that regenerates ammonia borane pretty readily.
Thank you, Andrew. John, before we get to putting hydrogen back in, what are the various methods for releasing hydrogen gas from ammonia borane?
So you can release the hydrogen from ammonia borane using several different methods. You can simply heat it and thermalize it. That will release hydrogen, although the rates of hydrogen release aren't what we'd like for transportation applications. You can also throw in various kinds of catalysts. We've particularly focused on metal-based catalysts simply because we believe, and others believe, that that will give you the best chance to optimize both the rate of release and the extent, in other words, the amount of hydrogen you get out, both of which are important factors, you know, for producing hydrogen that you then give to a fuel cell to power the car.
So of those methods for releasing hydrogen gas, and you said that you focused on metal-based catalysts, which one did you choose and why?
In our particular center, we focus mostly on metal-based catalysts. Now, from a practical standpoint, if you go to a global scale and you're going to be generating hydrogen from, you know, cars all over the planet, so to speak, you probably want to go to a catalyst that's based on an earth abundant metal. So we've actually focused a lot of our efforts on iron-based catalysts for that very reason.
To what extent does this process degrade the metal-based catalyst?
For example, an iron-based catalyst, we've tended to use iron catalysts in their +2 oxidation state. So ammonia borane itself tends to reduce the iron down in oxidation state to basically iron metal. So at some point you tend to see the catalyst degrade because it's basically falling apart to form iron metal. So you have to basically design some more robustness into the system to make its longevity better. And so we have actually thought about that quite a bit.
But iron's quite a bit more common than, say, platinum, these other ways of generating hydrogen.
That's correct. I mean, there are systems based on precious metals, platinum, rhodium, iridium, that are active for this. But based on the cost and how much of it actually exists on the planet, this precious metals, you'd ideally want to do it based on an earth-abundant system such as iron.
Andy, the question then of regenerating the spent fuel. So you start with ammonium borane. That generates the hydrogen and the polyboroxylene. Turning it back then into ammonia borane, with ammonia and with hydrazine, how does the method work?
So from polyboroxylene, if you do the reaction in solution with hydrazine, you generate hydrazine borane as a primary product. And if you gently heat a sample of hydrazine borane with a small amount of ammonia, you do see slight conversion to ammonia borane. So that was a driver of moving to a pressure reactor where we could actually use larger amounts of ammonia, put it under pressure, and actually heat it. And it was this reaction which managed to displace all the hydrazine, which could then go back and react with more polyboroxylene and be substituted by ammonia and get us back to ammonia borane.
So just to summarize, you take the polyboroxylene, you add hydrazine and ammonia, you put it into essentially a pressure cooker at some temperature, and voila, at the end of this, you end up with ammonia borane.
That's correct. And it goes at 40 degrees Celsius.
Thank you. John, to what if any extent are any of these chemicals, the inputs or outputs, toxic?
Actually, hydrazine itself is toxic. It's a carcinogen. But the way that this would be done is that we would not be moving truckloads of this stuff around the country or have it on a train going across from coast to coast. The way that you would technically do this is that you would catalytically generate the hydrogen at the point of use, which would be at the polyboroxylene or spent fuel recycle plant, and you'd consume it as you use it. So it would be there on site with the regen plant itself, and if you did it right, as soon as you made it, you would consume it in the regen cycle. So there wouldn't be the potential that, you know, a catload of it would fall off a train somewhere. So inherently, it's known to be a toxic material, but it's a potent reductant, and that's what makes it ideal from the standpoint of the chemistry.
So let's say we had a fuel cell hydrogen car. You would pull up to the station, you would empty your tank, and then fill it again.
No, what would happen in effect, and this is actually very important for people to understand, I think, is what you would do is you'd get the tank of the fuel, the hydrogen carrier, you'd release the hydrogen from that to power the fuel cell. You then drive, and originally the Department of Energy set some goals in that regard, and it was to try to drive a vehicle on the highway greater than 300 miles on a single tank fill. So once you then expended the fuel, you would take that off board and send it back to a recycle plant. You would then get a new fuel tank. So the regeneration chemistry itself would not be done on board the vehicle. It would be done at a dedicated recycle plant.
What about any of the chemical reactions? Are any of those hazardous?
As far as the regeneration chemistry,
Andy,
taking the polyboroxylene with the hydrazine and ammonia, the only real byproduct is nitrogen. So you take the hydrazine, you use all the hydrogen, and you're just left with nitrogen. This can then be recycled and reformed into ammonia. And the current cycle would take this to hydrazine and then back in to regenerate ammonia borane. So the process itself is only consuming hydrogen. And all the other byproducts from the regeneration can essentially be recycled. And the ammonia, which is used as a solvent, can be captured and then put back into the cycle as a solvent.
What, if any, other obstacles then need to be overcome to make this use of ammonia borane as a storage for hydrogen for, in turn, fuel cells, industrially or indeed commercially viable?
I think the most important part for the regen now is to get a more efficient way of making hydrazine. If we can do that, then that would bring the cost down and actually make this regeneration cycle pretty cheap.
Hydrazine right now is fairly expensive. How much does it cost?
Right now, hydrazine is about $4 a kilo for an aqueous solution. So the larger scale you go to, you know, you'd have to drop it lower than that. So coming up with methods to make it more efficiently and tying it into the overall cycle that is described in the paper is certainly, you know, a longer-term goal that we'd have to address.
Andrew Sutton and John Gordon, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Andrew Sutton and John Gordon are co-corresponding authors of a paper in this week's Science on regenerating ammonia borane spent fuel by direct reaction with hydrazine and liquid ammonia. There's a great deal of randomness in where, when, and how DNA mutates. And because of this, and the randomness of the environment, if there was some way to rewind the tape of evolution and replay it, life on Earth would likely be very different from what it is today. This idea of rewinding and replaying evolution was popularized some 20 years ago by evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould in his book Wonderful Life. Coincidentally, about 20 years ago, evolutionary biologist Richard Lenski started an evolution experiment with a common bacteria, E. coli. As the bacterial generations passed, Lenski and colleagues took samples from the bacterial population and froze them in time, if you will, literally by freezing them. Now, with some 50,000 generations passed, the team knows which bacterial lineages survived and which didn't, but in reviving the frozen, extinct lineages and replaying evolution, the team came to realize that the more evolutionarily fit bacteria often were the ones that went extinct. The team describes the result of their ongoing evolution experiment in a paper in this week's Science, and I spoke with Lenski and his co-corresponding author, Jeffrey Barrick, by telephone about it. Here's Rich Lenski.
So the paper is addressing the question of whether it's better to be fit or flexible. And as evolutionary biologists, we're asking about flexibility in the sense of evolvability, that is, the potential for populations to continue to adapt to the environment in which they live. And what our study shows is that long-term evolvability can sometimes trump short-term fitness. And that result is surprising from a theoretical perspective, because as is often emphasized, evolution isn't a foresighted process. So how is it that evolvability can evolve, that sort of potential to continue to make improvement in the future? And what we're looking at in this paper is just one population, and in fact, very early phases of one population in this long-term experiment that's been ongoing in my lab for now over 2 decades, tracking as they evolve now over 50,000 generations. And one of the neat methodological points about this bacterial system for studying evolution is that we've been freezing the intermediate steps along the way, and we can resurrect them and bring them back and ask how changing certain circumstances at particular points in time would affect the statistical distributions of future outcomes. So we have been focusing on this particular population for a lot of our genetics work. And Bob Woods had found that there were these genetic differences present even within this one population at generation 500.
The first author of the paper. Okay.
And so it made a lot of sense to think, well, the ones that, after we continued the evolution for all these thousands of generations, the ones that were the eventual winners, if we competed them against the eventual losers, we said, hey, the eventual winners are going to be the ones that are more fit than the eventual losers. But in fact, and this is where the paradox came and where the interesting hypotheses came in, is that the eventual losers were actually more fit than the eventual winners. And that's what set us on this train towards thinking, huh, what else could be causing it? Was it just luck that the eventual winners before they went extinct picked up a beneficial mutation, or was there something systematic about their genomes that made them more flexible?
So you noticed that these populations were already living well beyond when they should have died out based on competition. Jeff?
Yes.
And then you decided to essentially run this evolution again, replaying it.
Yes, multiple times from each of these two starting points.
The different generational starting points.
The different individuals that existed at that one time point. of the ones that were going to eventually go extinct and the ones that were eventually going to take over the population.
So those beneficial mutations in one of the populations of bacteria and the controlled environment, did that always mean that the bacteria that was labeled eventual winner always won? To what extent did that happen, Jeff?
It did not mean that every single time it won, but on average, once we waited the approximately 1,000 more generations that we evolved them, that those were ahead when you averaged across all of these different replay lineages.
Did the eventual winners who had these beneficial mutations evolve at a faster rate?
Correct.
Rich?
Exactly. That's the point. They started out with a lower fitness, but they evolve at a higher rate, and we were able to show that that's a systematic difference between the eventual winners and losers. As Jeff said, it's not a guaranteed outcome, but it's a statistically significant signature. And then from further work, we were able, by sequencing the genomes, to identify potential candidate mutations that might be contributing to this evolvability and test the actual underlying genetic basis.
Is it possible there were mutations that you and your team didn't capture or know about and that that led to the eventual result of this faster evolutionary rate?
So one of the really wonderful things for me about this long-term experiment has been not only the wonderful people like Jeff who've been working on it, but also the technologies that I couldn't even have dreamed about when this experiment started. And one of these technologies is the possibility of getting an entire genome sequence for the bacteria from this experiment and finding all of the mutational differences. So I do not think there are any hidden differences. And through Jeff's work and the other co-authors on this paper, we were able to identify a couple of genes that seem to be involved in a very important interaction affecting this difference in evolvability.
So as far as what Rich was alluding to is that
Jeff?
One really powerful thing about this system too is that we can go back and we can take the ancestor of the entire evolution experiment and pick out single mutations and put them into the ancestor. So there are no other mutations that might have been there during the evolution experiment. It's just you isolate the effect of that one mutation. And what was really great is that because we had replayed evolution so many times independently from each other, we were able to go in and find that the eventual winners were evolving mutations in one particular gene, not every time, but 6 out of the 20 times they evolved some mutation in this gene, whereas the eventual losers never evolved a mutation in this gene. And it turns out this gene was very, very beneficial in the eventual winners. And if we put back some combinations of mutations into the ancestor, we still see that benefit. But if we put back combinations of mutations that were in the eventual losers and those same mutations, we find that it was much, much less beneficial to get those mutations, or maybe not even beneficial. And so we can dissect some of these interactions that are at the leading edge of the most beneficial mutations that are what are important for achieving that high rate of evolution in this environment.
So the eventual losers were ones then that had some sort of limiter on their evolvability, if you will.
It appears to be that that's true. So it's not that the winners just have a higher fitness, it's that they're able to evolve better over longer periods of time and not become trapped in kind of partial evolutionary cul-de-sacs.
What, if any, implications does this have for our understanding of evolution?
I think theoretically, people have definitely thought about these questions for a long time. This is kind of one of the first cases where we've been able to show that in an evolving population, these differences in evolvability over time matter for the eventual winners. And interestingly, pull out some of the key genes, which tend to be things that regulate a lot of other genes, and start dissecting how those interact and how it determines your further ability to evolve.
Rich, does this have any implications for other species, or is it pretty much a theoretical understanding at this point?
This is an example that goes beyond the theoretical understanding and shows a concrete example. And to me, the fact that we can see something as complex as subtle differences in gene regulation affecting evolvability, if we can see that in a small world of a single flask with 10 milliliters and a few hundreds of millions of bacteria, if it's happening on that scale, undoubtedly similar processes are happening in the world all around us. The real world is very difficult to dissect and understand in this kind of detail, and that's the advantage of these experimental approaches to evolution. But I think it shows this is not just a theoretical possibility. This is something that matters for long-term evolutionary success.
Jeff Barrick and Rich Lenski, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert.
Jeff Barrick of the University of Texas at Austin and Rich Lenski of Michigan State University are co-corresponding authors of a paper in this week's Science on evolvability and their team's finding that it can be better for an organism's survival to be evolutionarily flexible than evolutionarily fit. If you missed our regular Science Now segment, it will be back. In the meantime, you can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, including our ongoing coverage of the Sendai earthquake and its aftermath, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the March 18th, 2011 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.